After 25 years in the fashion industry, I've realized that fashion is not really about the clothes, it's about the people. I'm Laura Van Root Poole, and this is What We Wore. Stephanie Summerson Hall is the passionate entrepreneur behind Estelle Colored Glass, named for her grandmother who taught her the value of collecting a beautiful, entertaining collection. Stephanie's story is a gift to any of our listeners who are budding entrepreneurs and looking for inspiration on their path. Stephanie Summerson Hall, I wish we were still in Amagansett talking, but we are talking over Zoom. But that was such an incredible event. And I'm embarrassed to say, Stephanie, that was my first time in the Hamptons. I'd never been, and to be really honest, I'd never really wanted to go. I just kind of never had an interest in it. And I was so blown away by how beautiful it was, but most especially, I think, how beautiful the dinner was that we attended that you contributed. It was all Estelle Glass on the entire dinner, and it was one of the prettiest things I've seen.
Well, thank you. It was not my first time, but it's always nice to visit Amagansett because it's just such a quaint little, almost in picturistic little place. And, you know, it's just really nice little.
Idyllic. Stephanie, will you tell the listeners where you're from?
I grew up in Holly Hill, South Carolina, in between Columbia, South Carolina and Charleston.
And what was it like growing up there? What's the population?
Just a few thousand, probably 200 people in my graduating class. A lot of people who've grown up here, you know, not a lot of newcomers, you know, kind of same families. And I had a really good upbringing. I'm a very, very loving and supportive community. Teachers who really cared, who'd been there for, like, institutions, teachers who were institutions and, you know, really dedicated their lives. It was a really nice church family. It was nice.
And your family's still there?
Yeah, my family's still here. My dad and my mom, their families live about 15 minutes apart. I purposely moved back home in 2010, having lived, you know, several different places. And I craved for, like, my children to live around family members and cousins and people that have known me my whole life. So that was something that I was very intentional about putting them, giving them that same experience.
Your grandmother, Estelle, was she your maternal or your paternal grandmother?
It's my dad's mother and my paternal grandmother. Yes.
Will you tell me a little bit about her?
I just spent so much time at her house. Just every area of my life. I mean, she just was a big presence in, you know, in my life. I mean, she was definitely had a lot to say and really exerted her influence, you know, in your life. She wasn't, like, very passive. She was, you know, definitely more direct, a more direct person. So she told you what, she gave you her opinions. She gave you her advice, all those things. But I mean, in a very subtle way. I mean, she didn't overstep my parents or anything. But she just was that figure that, and, you know, especially as I got older, you kind of knew what, you know, where she stood on things. And she found opportunities to instill in you a value system that really is, you know, very strong. She definitely was a strong influence in my life. And again, just there's nothing, no area of my life I don't think of her fondly and her influence and her wisdom.
Did you have siblings also? I mean, did y'all go over there after school?
No, we didn't go over there after school because she actually worked. So we didn't go over after school. But, you know, you were just there, like, you know, on Sundays for dinners and, well, during the holidays, we would almost have like a whole week of celebrations at our house. One of my dad's sisters lived in New York, and she came home for 2 weeks every year. And so my grandmother's house was the, you know, central. she didn't have any children. She would, like, just, I mean, like, soak up every minute of being home for the holidays. So she had something going. She would plan, like, dinners every night. You know, nothing real fancy, but just, like, all of her favorite things she wanted to eat while she was home. She would, like, make these pots of this and pots of that.
Do you remember any of them specifically? What were some of her favorites?
Well, we had this pork pot that was a wonderful, definitely, one night we had that always. She'd have, you know, fried fish and we'd have red rice with our fried fish. So we'd have that one night. we'd have, I mean, we'd run down the whole list of things. Oh, another thing was like a catfish stew.
Oh, yum.
A catfish stew one night. I mean, it was just a big family reunion for a whole 2 weeks.
And it was always around the table, or, I mean, typically around the table?
It was at my grandmother's house. You know, it wasn't necessarily dinners where everybody, the table was set, but everybody would get a plate, you know. The adults would sit at the tables, you know, but it was very casual. It was, these dinners were during, you know, like I said, every night, so during the week. Those were not dinners at my grandmother's dining room table. These were dinners at the more casual table in the kitchen and, you know, and the family room kind of tables, you know, and best times of your life as a child, you know. My aunt would bring home all these gifts from, like, the streetwear from New York. So you got the belt buckles with your name on it. You got all these like puffy coats, and it was just so exciting to see. You know, you'd tell her what you wanted, and she would bring it. So
I love it. And all the cousins would be there too, and so everybody had their wish list. And
She would bring all of us gifts, and you know, so yeah, all my my dad has several siblings that live in just streets away from each other. So all of us would be there, and extended family members. The house would be packed for almost like I said, it would be like a 2 week ongoing celebration until my aunt left.
I love it. And everybody would rest.
You're right about that. So my grandmother would be hosting, you know, it would just be at her house, and she would be there, and, you know, she'd be help cooking, and, you know, it would just be a really good time, honestly. And, you know, it's just the best childhood memories ever.
Oh, you know? I love that. And so amazing that your business really became that entertaining and sharing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the things I'm honestly most proud of. Like, you know, we share a lot on our social media of the glasses being used at dinner time, being, you know, used at parties and setting the table. And I'm really, it makes me really happy to see these, because, you know, that's one of the things that was my connection to colored glass. Like, you know, the pieces are memorable. And so it's just certain elements, you know, like strong points, you know, that you remember a certain events or numerous events in a certain phase of your life. And I just remember my grandmother had colored glass serving dishes. She had all kinds of different, you know, in her china cabinet. She had one more casual china cabinet and one of a more formal china cabinet in her formal dining room. So she just had all of her really nice, beautiful pieces. And so to the extent that I'm helping contribute some what I believe are beautiful pieces to all of these, you know, our community. Yeah. That makes me very happy. And you know, and that's, you know, an inspiration to me every day when I see people using the pieces at dinner, even if it's a more casual, just weeknight dinner, and they take the time to tag us. It's just, it really does give me like inspiration.
I think that was for a long time was a lost thing, because my grandmother probably was about your grandmother's age, and my grandmother loved her crystal. It was like her favorite thing. And she would go, well, I bought this at this place and I had wanted this one, but I couldn't afford it. So then I waited 5 years and then I got, you know, it was like all these elaborate stories about how important this crystal was to her. And then I feel like when we were growing up, it wasn't so much like our parents, maybe it wasn't so much a thing, but I feel like you've really brought that back.
My own mother, my grandmother as well, really ingrained in building collections. You build, like, just have some really unique pieces.
Yep.
You know, when you need to pull them out, you pull them out.
Yeah.
That's just something that, you know, any good hostess is going to just have some really investment pieces that they're going to be able to pull out, even if they're not, you know, even if they're if it's an eclectic collection. You know, my grandmother did, you know, yard sales, estate sales. One of our favorite stores was a store called Roses. It was like the predecessor to Kmart, or yeah. Actually they're still in existence now in certain places. There's one in that's like 30 from us.
And I remember Roses.
She spent hours, and that was one of her, I would almost say her favorite store. So she spent hours in it. So she would always just be finding, you know, nice things, you know, probably there she was buying more everyday things. It would be a travesty to her to pull out like plastic plates or paper plates for anybody. You know, she never, I never saw her fix anybody's plate on, you know, anything that was disposable. That was, that was almost, well, that was probably wasteful to her too. You know, she, if she was even making dinner for, you know, a grandchild, just a casual one, or in a open kitchen, she was going to give you a proper spoon and a proper plate.
Did she teach you how to set the table? Because my grandmother taught me.
Well, I mean, not a proper setting of the table, but, you know, just by example of seeing her do it. And like when probably the highest level of entertaining I saw my grandmother do was like when the preacher, preacher was over after church on Sunday.
That's
and,
a big
his
deal.
Wife and guests from the church would come over. And so, you know, you just saw how it's like, you know, bringing out the food and the proper bowls and the, you know, your plates and everything go on. I can't say she just per se just sat me down and said, this is how it's done. I saw what she made for dinners and how she used seasonal ingredients and you know, number, you know, she'd have three, maybe, and she'd probably never have anything, not have at least 3 to 4 meats of like a dinner for a preacher. And you have, you know, at least 2 to 3 vegetables and your starches and, you know, all the side dishes, you know, that are traditional here, like, you know, the mac and cheese and the potato salad and all these different things.
Stephanie, as a little girl, what did you want to do? What did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a lawyer. I was very consistent with saying that. There was a woman who grew up here too, and she had gone to the I attended the University of South Carolina. She'd gone to Georgetown Law School, and she was a partner at a law firm in Washington, D.C., and she was an African-American woman. And so my mother was a hairstylist. She owned a hair salon, and the woman's mother was one of my mom's customers. So I found out about the woman. I knew about her, and then in the local paper did a story about her. And I was like, I want to do that. That was early middle school. When I saw her having reached that level of, you know, in her profession, you know, being a lawyer, not that I even knew what a partner in a law firm was, you know, but having, you know, her education, her background, everything, I just said, I just saw myself being able to take that. If she took that path and got where she, you know, where she ended up, I set a goal to myself. I'm going to go to law school.
And tell me about being a lawyer. Did you love it once you got there?
My first job was a clerkship with a judge that was the chief judge on the highest court in Maryland, which is their Court of Appeals. You know, that was a very prestigious job to get out of law school. So when I got there, of course, the judge was, he was an Harvard educated African-American judge. I mean, he just gave us the experience was just, I mean, a phenomenal experience. I mean, the best job I ever had, you know. And then from there, I went and clerked for the top judge on the District of Columbia. And she was an African-American female judge. So those were, you know, those were some phenomenal experiences. And did they live up to them? Yes, they did. Now, when I actually got to the practice of law, it did not, honestly. because I don't know, you had this, you know, this idea that, you know, you're going to go to court, you were going to be, you know, you're going to get in these settings and you're going to be appreciated. And it was the reality and the dream, you know, it was so different.
Did you feel setbacks from being a woman?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it really is a double whammy, you know, being a Black and a woman. The best way I can summarize it is either you're discounted or you're dismissed. And, you know, in different settings, I was both happened. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was just not an experience where you were going to feel. Now, when I, like I said, when I was with these judges who were very intentional about trying to mentor African-American new lawyers in those settings, the mentoring was great. But, you know, the reality of it is when you're like, you know, such a minority in these large organizations, it's just not going to be the best experience. The experience itself really does age you, you know, when you have to get up and you have to face this day in and day out, and it's not very nurturing, and it's very almost antagonistic, and you're marginalized, and it's like I said, the dream and the reality is definitely you get
worn down.
Yeah, you get worn down very easily. I really didn't see where it was gonna all of a sudden become what I thought it would be. I never saw a pathway after, you know, I practiced for 10 years. So after a number of years, you know, you're like, and then you talk to other people and you're like, well, how's that going for you? You know, and
yeah.
you know, And so I'm like, well, 10 years is more like 25. You know what I mean? So I said, well, you know, the trade-offs. I mean, so I've got to work all these long hours and my work is marginalized. I'm not very appreciated here. At the cost of what? And for me, am I going to continue to do this or am I going to chart my own path? And, you know, if I'm not going to get a proper seat at the table, am I going to create my own table?
I think you're married and you have children. Like, did you discuss it with your husband and say, like, I can't do this anymore? Or your grandmother? Or who was the person that said, just stop? Like, it's killing you. Don't do this anymore. Or was it just you?
I really kind of, I'll let you in when I made my decision. I kind of do all the head work and all the, you know, the mental process myself. I really don't really, I'm not the kind of person that needs to talk something over with people. And I make up my own mind. Really, for me, it was a decision that I made, and then I just told everybody else what I was going to be doing. You know,
I like that.
And I was making it over time because I'm like, I'd rather read the business section of a newspaper, you know, and it was for several different, you know, reasons, different angles why I would say the law was, in the end, was not probably the best fit for me. The skill set that I gained, am I using it today? Yes, I am. Was good for me, but it wasn't a part of my long-term trajectory, honestly. I moved back to home to South Carolina, and I had, by that time, I had decided I'm not going to practice anymore. It was that, you know, and I had, you're right, I had a young family, and I, you know, I got married while I was practicing and everything, but I just, you know, I said, I'm not going to practice anymore. While I was practicing, I started a business, the event rental business. It was 5 years up and running when I decided to leave the practice of law, so it was something that I could use to leave the practice of law. And I said, well, I'm just going to, you know, I had young children. I'm just going to become a full-time entrepreneur. Did I know that, you know, the rental business was not all I was, you know, it had really no connection to me, you know, what, you know, but I just saw it as a, it was something actually I was helping. It was a family kind of venture that I kind of set up myself. And I saw it as, you know, something exciting to work on. But I was an absentee owner for all those years, and but I was working on it, and I, you know, and I enjoyed the work, and I just said, I'm just going to build out this business.
It was an event rental business, so like you rented dishes and silverware and things for parties, is that right?
Yeah, and more so tents and tables and chairs.
And it was in Holly Hill?
It's based in Holly Hill, but most of our, you know, it's more of a regional business. Most of our customers are, you know, we service a lot of different, you know, areas like Charleston is a major area we service, a lot of different areas around the Lowcountry. It was enough for us to come with our family. My husband, you know, he was working in corporate, and, you know, he basically, this business was already going. And so we decided, you know, this is enough for us at least to make the transition. So we transitioned back here and we worked in the business. And then that's when I, you know, just started to dibble and dab and some other things. And Estelle was one of them.
Estelle wasn't the first part. There was something else that you started within the events business, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. Well, I started an online store. But like with the rentals being the meat and potatoes.
Right.
Our family, I started delving into other things. So online store was one of them as well. Yes.
And tell me about that. You had to completely learn how to do e-com just on your own?
Yeah. You know, unless you're just starting with a lot of resources and, you know, and just being another fish in the sea, you know, it's hard, you know, and we didn't, like the name was not unique. The products we were selling, products, it was my twist on it was artists, beautiful artists and products. And so that aesthetic was, you know, wasn't a necessarily, you know, unique aesthetic. It just was a disaster because, you know, I could never really get any traction with it.
Right.
But all the lessons I learned from that is what really brought me to Estelle, because I said, well, you know, I got to find something that is a very unique product. You know, it can't be easily duplicated.
Right.
If you want to start a glass company, particularly like a colored glass company, you're going to have a hard time finding someone to produce your pieces.
Right.
I think we've been credited with helping to bring about a revival of colored glass.
Yeah.
One of the proudest moments is when New York Times article said, you know, we were credited with bringing back a revival of colored glass. And that was something that I was very intentional about. The uniqueness of the product, you know, and the production of it and high quality, all those things made for a niche kind of product and can't be easily duplicated. So that's why I said, you know, I'm selling all these. What are the downfalls of having this e-commerce? Was I was selling at all these 100 different products, and I was dealing with 70 different vendors, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a long time before I was going to make any money, because you got to buy a minimum product, yeah. You know, products, and you know, and then I'm not getting rid of it, and all these different things. And the lesson I learned from that is, if I have one vendor to deal with, I expand on the product line. You know, it's all colored glass.
And so, Stephanie, what was the first colored glass product that you created?
Well, the first piece I was working on was our kickstands, and I hired an industrial designer, the 100-year glass maker, said that they could make it. And so, okay, I'm on to something. And then we, you know, we paired it with the stemware. So our inaugural collection consisted of stemware pieces in 7 different colors, and our kickstand in about 5 different colors.
And did it sell, all of it sell just immediately like crazy?
No.
Ah.
Because nobody knew about it.
How did you share with them about it? How did people begin to know about it?
Had the website up and running. You know, we were doing, you know, we, of course, reaching out. We didn't have a lot of resources, so we reached out to, you know, the media and Charleston Wedding Magazine. We had a pre-existing relationship with them from our rental company.
Right.
They would, like, periodically reach out and say, what are you working on? What's new? And I said, well, I'm starting a colored glass company. And they were like, really? And like, and so I had pictures and sent the pictures, and they were like, can you bring them to the studio? And that was the first magazine that gave us, you know, a spread.
Stephanie, were you set up to sell at that point? I mean, it's like they say, be careful what you wish for, you know, be ready when you're.
Well, my first order was not a lot of product.
Okay.
You know, I think we had like 300 pieces of each of the colors we had.
That sounds like a lot.
Well, I mean, 50 sets of it. I don't know how many kickstands, but not a lot at all. And
okay.
I'm glad we didn't have a lot of kickstands, because we had to go back and tweak our design on the kickstands. Yeah.
And what year was this about?
It started in 2019.
Okay. Oh my God. I can't believe that. I want to hear about that too, about the pandemic and like how, because you grew from 20,000 followers to 300,000 followers in like a year. Tell me about that.
That first Christmas, we probably had about maybe 30 orders. And that was like, ooh, that was, you know, fantastic. You know, we just get started, you know, because we started in 2019, October of 2019. That's when we introduced the product to the public, the brand to the public.
Right.
And so we had those orders for Christmas. You know, we've gotten a few orders in between that, but not a lot. You know, next year I'm planning to go to a trade show, all that stuff. really start like a wholesale program and all that. And then like 2 weeks before we were, the show was going to actually be starting, we'd already had, you know, everything, the booth and everything. We got an email saying the show had been canceled because of something called COVID-19.
You have an event business and then an entertaining business. When COVID-19 happened, were you like, okay, these businesses are over?
All of our events were canceled. What happened is we had product on the shelf, because remember, like I told you, we'd ordered 300 of each piece.
Right.
So we sold a couple of each color during the holidays. So we had, you know, decent amount on the shelves.
Right.
So what happened is, dude, COVID hit, and then we started getting a lot more traffic, and, you know, we were online, you know, trying to engage with build the community. We started getting orders from people engaging with us online. And so we were coming in and, you know, and shipping product. And then when the George Floyd events happened, there was this move on the internet. People said, well, you know, systemic racism has affected Black businesses, which is very true.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the Instagram said, well, we're going to throw our support around. We want to hear your stories. We're going to amplify Black businesses.
Right.
And then we're going to support these Black businesses. And so that was a moment when really it was a turning point for us, because we were a Black business. A female Black business, you know, like it's a female business, it's a Black business. Two things is working in my favor now.
Yeah.
And so every major like magazine came knocking at our door. I was doing several interviews at a day.
Wow.
We made so many different lists. You know, the people went started looking for searching for Black businesses. You know, and then they wanted to tell their readers, here's a product you can buy. And ta-da, we had products they could buy.
Did you feel ready for it when it came? Like, were you prepared?
Well, I mean, prepared or not, you know, I was. We started getting a ton of followers. And like I said, every Architectural Digest, Veranda, Martha Stewart, people not only, they weren't necessarily doing the print magazines because everybody was at home, but they were doing this, online, which is just as important as, or just as impactful as the print media. But all of these magazines knocked on our door and wanted to do stories for us. It was just a really a tremendous opportunity, and it was just timing. And do you have product on your shelf that people could buy now? Yes, we do. And is this something that people could, people could use and they wanted to buy? It was not a black product. It wasn't a white product. It wasn't a Hispanic product.
It's a beautiful product.
It was a universal product. So that really was an opportunity for us to get our brand. And we got more PR than I think most brands probably would get in 10 years. Honestly, the 3-month period.
Yeah.
I mean, we were in every magazine. And the good thing about it is that not only that, but we've had the magazines come back over and over again. So.
And was that stressful or was it, I mean, it was exciting, obviously, but was it scary? Was it stressful?
It wasn't because, we sold a lot of product. We've got more product being produced. It's going to take, we had customers that waited 3 months on our product.
Wow.
It became stressful when, oh gosh, we don't have this product. We kept selling. We told the customers that, we're going to restock on this is when your product's going to ship. And nobody said, you had a few people who needed it for gifts. They'd walk away, but 98% of the people waited on the product. So
wow.
it was really life changing, honestly. And that's what we were doing. Our company, that was our pivot. All the rental people, we were able to come back to work. We just had this tremendous amount of growth.
And one of the things that I know you're proud of that I'm really proud of is that you employ a large amount of people in your own community in Holly Hill, don't you? Tell me how many people work with you.
Yeah. So our brand is, we have a handful of remote people, in different states and that sort of thing. But the vast majority, 75% of the people live about, 30 miles or less. Honestly, about 50% of them live like within 10 minutes.
Stephanie, how many people work with y'all?
We are inching past 40. So
okay. Awesome.
During the holidays, we'll be probably up to about 50. That's the absolute most thing I'm fulfilled about is being able to offer well-paying jobs, with health insurance that we cover.
Yeah.
In our community. It's just a tremendous, it's something I feel personally that my grandmother would be very proud of. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, absolutely. And so I'm that's the thing, it's one thing to be able to support my family, but to be able to offer to contribute something to my community and to help with the economic revitalization, that is very fulfilling.
Tell me what the future of Estelle Glass looks like, Estelle Colored Glass.
Well, for now, we're celebrating our third birthday starting in October. In terms of our growth, we have a lot of opportunities for growth. We've had a tremendous amount of growth.
Yeah, and I'll say.
honestly, we'll be reevaluating a lot of things after the holiday season. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing now is really just continuing to tell our story and get these, what we believe is a beautiful product in the hands of our community and building our community. The business side of things will take care of itself, whatever decisions I need to make. At the helm of the brand, I will make in intelligent decisions. But for now, we're just telling our story and helping again with the revitalization of our community.
Yeah, it's amazing. How do you think being an entrepreneur has changed your family life?
It allowed me to be intentional. I was actually just having a conversation with someone today. I'm intentional about this stage of my life with my kids. I have 4 children. I come into the office. I'm usually here 3 days a week. I'm home 2 days a week. And if I need to switch that around, I'll switch it around. But my daughter's volleyball coach this fall for their YMCA volleyball team. I'm home a lot. All of our staff goes home at 12 o'clock on Friday and we're closed all weekend. You know, people have a good quality of life, I believe.
So nice.
And, yes. So, you know, it's just, I'm just being very intentional about where I put my focus and my attention. And I'm just going to enjoy this, you know, this ride, this, you know, this phase of life, honestly. And I don't think that, you know, as an entrepreneur, you know, it could go, you know, even entrepreneurs, you know, definitely working hard. And I had to, you know, you have to be creative. Like, I don't watch 1 hour of TV a week. And that's really, but I do spend time like, you know, social media, engaging with the community and different things that I do personally myself. Even though, you know, I have marketing people and other people to hand it off to, but I just try to live like my passion, you know what I mean? Find a way to make it a part of my life without being work. So what I'm doing doesn't really even feel like work on social media, but it is really work. But at the same time, I'm at home, I'm making dinner, I'm able to take my kids. I'm able to let them, you know, enjoy different different experiences without having to be tugged in different directions. I knew 75 hours a week I was working as a lawyer was not going to be, as a mother, not something I could buy. You know, you're not going to sell that to me because there's got to be another way.
What's your number one piece of advice for somebody with a business idea that they haven't acted on?
People say, well, I got this gig I'm going to start doing on the weekends, or I'm going to start this. And I said, well, let me, you know, you got to do a cause analysis, because if you have a job, you really got to make sure it's going to be something that you can make money from. You know, if you're going to call it a business, it's not not a hobby.
Right.
You really got to see the financial potential there for profits, not just making money, but profits.
Yeah.
And then you got to see how much money you're going to make. You know, if you can make some money, is it going to be a lot of money or a little bit of money? And if it's not going to be a lot of money, you honestly, I tell people all the time, if I were you, I would value my time more than that. You know, if you have a job and you have a career, don't go at it yourself. If you can't really, you know, the impact that you're going to have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just to say I'm doing it myself, because I mean, there's a lot of work and a lot of things. If you work for someone else, a lot of things that are not, you're not going to be on your shoulders. So I would definitely do an analysis and if even if you're just getting started, value your time. Put the, you know, if it's something for me, if it's something that requires me now to take away time on the weekends for my children when they're in their, you know, in middle school and, you know, going into high school and they've got so much going on, my presence is a gift to them.
Yeah.
My presence is a top priority for me. It's priceless. Your money isn't even my key driver, you know, my driving force, you know what I mean? But so I think you just really have to evaluate it. But if it's something when all the boxes check off and you really believe in it, and if even something's creative that's not even going to make a lot of money, but you just really want to do this and you know you can make a living from it, I would just say go for it. Start small. Use your community as a launching pad. If you can involve the e-commerce now and sell your product all over, you know, for now, we sell our product all over the world. So it doesn't live in the community you want to live in.
Right, exactly.
And make it automated if you can. And make it, don't create something very complicated. For me, at this stage in my life, I want something very simplified. At the end of the day, what we do is we sell beautiful glass. And you know, with tools like Shopify, this can be done very easily. And we go home. We go home on the weekends and we don't have to worry about it because we're open 24/7.
Is Estelle your forever business or do you think you're a serial entrepreneur?
Oh, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I'm definitely already working on, you know, and I have some other ventures, some other business dealings, but I have another brand that I'm going to build and I'm already working on it.
Oh, I can't wait for that.
Yeah.
One thing also I wanted to say, I think for me in selling clothes, you know, one of the biggest joys is to see somebody in the wild wearing your clothes and just seeing people, the joy of people loving their things. And I think being with you at that dinner in Amagansett and to see that table set and to hear the oohing and aahing, I mean, I'd never seen anything like that. And I thought, for me, that felt like such an accomplishment, and what a joy for you to be able to see people enjoying what you created.
You're so right. I'm always so fascinated. And that's part of my job, going out and talking with people and getting, telling the story. And I'm so humbled by the reaction I get. And And we are a lot alike because we get to curate these things and we get to treasure hunt.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know, and for me, I mean, that's something, that's not work. It's, you know, it's passion, really, you know?
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying, you know, what I've built. Because you don't want to build something that you're not going to enjoy. You know, yeah. That's not going to bring you any fulfillment and any pleasure.
What do you think your grandmother would think about what you created?
I mean, I've always been a very serious person and always have been like on the straight and narrow and done things that I've set out to do. So I would think that she wouldn't be so surprised, you know, that I've actually followed through with something and done a good, you know, done
a really good job.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I put my whole heart into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, and didn't give up, you know, even when I was had all the failures and all these setbacks, I would think that she would already know, she knows that, you know, that I was going to be a person that's going to take lemons and make lemonade and make a contribution and be productive.
And serve it in a beautiful glass. We ask everyone on the podcast what they wore to the prom. And I am so excited to hear about the prom fashions in Holly Hill.
Well, I never was like a long dress person. Honestly, I always wore like, you know, at least knee length dresses or like a little bit higher.
Uh-huh.
The first time I wore a black dress that had black, it had like tiered ruffles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not actually, it would probably be okay today. And it was sleeveless and it had the top of it was all sequins. And then I had these earrings on. I had my hair in this style, it was called weaves.
Oh, sounds pretty.
It was a pulled up hairstyle. And I had these kind of like.
Did your mom do it?
She did do it.
I love it.
Yeah. And then it was like the sequins on the earrings matched the dress. And it was like a little dot in my ear. And then it was a little ball that dropped down.
Oh, I love it. And did you shop for it in Columbia or was there a place in Holly Hill to shop?
I don't know where I got that dress from. Honestly, I can't remember. Probably at a mall in Charleston. That's where we.
Okay, that's where y'all would shop. Okay.
Yeah. We did most of our shopping in Charleston at this mall called Northwoods Mall.
Did you make sure your date had a matching? Did he have a sequin tie or anything?
No. He had no. These were not the times of all of these matching. He just had a basic black suit on with a black bow tie.
I love it.
And you know what? And my corsage was a red roses.
Oh, I love it. Oh, Stephanie, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today and share your story. It's very, very inspiring. What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.